Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Bio241, and it's September 2nd, and it's Thursday. Don't forget, Monday's a holiday. Nobody's coming to class, but you don't have class for this class anyway on Monday. But on Tuesday you do, and it's a special day on Tuesday. What's happening Tuesday? Yeah, you got your first test on Tuesday, right? And that's going to cover chapters 1, 2, 3, and 6. 1, 2, 3, and 6, so we got to finish 6 up today. There's a chance that we can do that. All right, now for the test, you need a pencil, you need a good eraser. Not just any eraser. It's got to be one that you know erases. Check it out. Make a mark on a clean piece of paper with your pencil, erase it with your eraser, and if it smudges up, guess what? Throw the eraser away immediately and go get one that works. All right, so I gave you a list in your syllabus of ones that I found really, really helpful. So I expect that you all know how to fill out a Scantron. If you don't, see me during office hours before the test, right? And I'll help you with that. The Scantron can't be spindled or mutilated or all marked up, right? It's got to be nice and clean when you turn it in. So it's got to be that way before you start. You also need your Cypress College or Fullerton College picture ID. All right, so if you don't have that, go over to admissions, get that going, because I can't release a grade to you unless I know who you are. And the third thing you need is your basic scientific calculator. All right, and so it's got to be non-graphing, and you can't share calculators during the test. You can't share anything, right? You can't share tests, can't share pencils, can't share erasers, can't share calculators, or anything like that. Yeah. I don't think your phone will work because it doesn't have a log function. Oh, you do. That's interesting. I would prefer not. I would prefer not. I might have a couple extra calculators that I'll bring in that, you know, you can use when you're done with the rest of the test. But now every calculator is a little bit different when you do log functions and inverse and things like that. So it's actually best to bring in a calculator you know how to use, right, and have practiced with. Because some work with parentheses, some don't work with parentheses. All that kind of stuff. All right, and don't forget during the test, no hats, no hoods, no sunglasses. Got to go to the bathroom before the test, not during the middle of the test. Right, just all that kind of stuff. All right. All right, so we got finished. Oh, here's a calculator that I can show you how to use a little bit later. I'll bring that one in during the test. Yes, question? When you're done with the test, you're welcome to leave. We won't have lecture afterwards. So you have an hour and a half to take the test, which is probably plenty of time. It won't be 100 questions on this first test, but the subsequent tests will get a little bit longer. But the first one, I think, only has maybe 85 or 90 questions on it, which is kind of bad for you, which means you can't miss as many, right? So the more questions, the better, but, you know, you got to kind of get speeded up in the class. Yeah. Oh, you always have an online quiz, 11 p.m. Let's do 11 p.m. I think mostly it is. I think it's going to be 6 and maybe 3, chapter 3 and 6, something like that. So that will reinforce, that will help you with the lecture exam. It sure will.
So we're not going over chapter 4 exams?
That's going to be on the next test. That will be on the next test. And I have that in the syllabus right here. So the first exam is 1, 2, 3, and 6. Exam 2, 4, 5, 7, and 9. We'll see if we can keep to that schedule. But so right now, exam 1, 1, 2, 3, and 6. All right, so we got to finish up 6. We were talking about diffusion last time, and you should know some things about diffusion. For instance, is it an active or a passive process? Okay, diffusion is a passive process. Diffusion, yeah, okay, hold on, you guys. Diffusion is a passive process. All right, that means a couple of things. Does it require energy? No, it happens automatically. It happens automatically because molecules move from where to where? High concentration to low. Just think of my car, right? It can roll down the hill passively, but to get up the hill, you got to spend energy to do that. And the reason why my car can roll down the hill is because when you have a gradient, energy is stored in that gradient. If it's a concentration gradient of chemicals, there is energy stored in that gradient, and if you have energy available to you, you can actually do work with it, right? Okay. What did I convert the energy in my car into? When it was parked on top of the hill, started to roll down the hill, what did I convert that energy into? Okay, because say the battery was dead. There was no energy in the battery, but I converted that motion rolling down the hill into starting my car since I didn't have energy in the battery, right? So energy can be converted that way. All right, osmosis is similar to diffusion in that it is passive. It's a passive process. All right, and does anybody know what the three criteria are for osmosis? We haven't talked about it yet, but that was a homework problem. Okay, and make sure you can fill that in. There are three important criteria for osmosis. All right, so let's talk about osmosis. Let's consider a chamber right here that has water and some solutes. What's a solute? Something dissolved in the solvent, right? So it could be glucose, it could be salt or something like that, or amino acids. And you can see that these, they kind of look purple to me. These purple dots, can you see there's a higher concentration of these dark dots on the right-hand side compared to the left? Which means there's more water on the left compared to the right. All right, so there's a higher concentration on the left of water compared to the right-hand side. So water molecules are going to want to move from left to right, down their concentration gradient by a passive process, right? Okay, by diffusion. All right, but now let's consider that we put a membrane between these two compartments right here, and we're going to put some holes in that membrane. And we see that the water molecules can move through these holes or pores in the membrane easily because they're small. But these solute molecules, like glucose, that's a big molecule. It's too big to move through these pores right here. Glucose is stuck. If they're on one side, they got to stay there. Even if there's a concentration gradient, they can't move through the membrane. They're stuck because they're too big, right? But water can. All right, so since these molecules, since the glucose molecules are too big, we say that those particles are osmotically active. They can force water to move. So which way is water going to move? Passively, from high to low. It's going to move from left to right, so water is going to move through this membrane. All right, so what can you tell me about this membrane in terms of its permeability to all the molecules that you see right there? Does it allow all the molecules to go through?
No,
only some. So it's a special kind of membrane. We say that it is selectively or semi-permeable, right? So it can allow water, but not other big molecules. That's an important criteria for osmosis. There has to be a membrane that is selectively permeable. The other important thing about osmosis is that the molecule that moves through the membrane has to be the solvent molecule. And in people, what's the solvent molecule? Water, right? So for biology, we always consider water. But if you're an organic chemist, you might think of some other kinds of solvents, right? But for biology, it's water. So osmosis, right, it's got to be diffusion, right, going from high concentration to low. That's number one. Number two, there's got to be a selectively permeable membrane. And the molecule that is moving passively has got to be the solvent molecule, which is water. So those are the three criteria for osmosis. It's got to be water, it's got to be simple diffusion, and it's got to be through a semi-permeable membrane. And then if all those criteria are met, then indeed that is a process that we call osmosis. All right, so let's actually quantitate this a little bit, okay, and talk about osmotic pressure. So here we start with these two chambers again with a selectively permeable membrane in between them. And we see that the concentration of solute, all right, so we're not talking about water right now. Let's talk about the stuff that's dissolved in water. In this particular case, it's glucose. On the left, it's only 180 grams per liter, and on the right, it's double that. It's twice as concentrated in glucose, 360. All right, so where is water the highest? It's over here on the left, indeed. So water can move through this membrane, but glucose can't. All right, and so does that qualify for osmosis? Yeah, because water is diffusing, the membrane is selectively permeable, and it's moving down a concentration gradient, just diffusion. So when water moves into this right-hand compartment, right, there's more molecules there, so that compartment has to get bigger to accommodate those water particles. And indeed, the membrane gets pushed over to the side like that. All right, so now the left-hand side volume is a lot smaller than the right-hand side volume. But if we look now at the concentration of solute and then the concentration of water, what has happened? They are now equal. All right, so diffusion will stop when there's no longer a concentration difference, right? So osmosis is going to stop when the concentration is the same on either side of the membrane, but you realize that the membrane had to move over to accommodate all that water that moved in. These channels in living cells that allow water to move through are called aquaporins, water pores. Not all cells have water pores, but many do, okay? And including red blood cells. So that water that moved into the right-hand side compartment actually built up some pressure to force the membrane over. And we can measure that pressure by pushing the membrane back. How much pressure do we have to exert on this membrane to get it back exactly where it was? All right, so we push on the membrane to get it back exactly where it was, and we measure that pressure, and we call that osmotic pressure as a result. All right, so that osmotic pressure is developed because of unequal concentrations of solute molecules on one side of the membrane compared to the other. But furthermore, right, it means that that solute molecule can't move through. If it can't move through the membrane, it is osmotically active. If it can move through, then that's a different kind of process. Okay. So that is osmosis. Make sure you know those three criteria. All right, we got to deal with a couple little chemistry principles right here because we want to learn something more about osmosis. We got to compare what's the difference between a molar solution and a molal solution. It's a little bit different. Okay, but we're going to make a solution. All right, and what's the solution again? It's part solvent and part solute, right? So we're going to be mixing a solvent in with some particles. So the particle that we're going to use, do we say what it is right here? Oh, yeah, glucose. We're going to use glucose. And you should probably know, why does glucose go into solution very nice? Okay, monosaccharides do because it's a very polar kind of molecule. There are polar covalent bonds. These monosaccharides have an oxygen bound to a hydrogen. And remember that oxygen is really greedy with electrons. It really pulls that one electron away from hydrogen, and it just leaves that positive charge just kind of sticking off the molecule, and so it can form hydration shells very easily in water. So we take one mole of glucose, which is 180 grams. You probably should be able to calculate that. Remember, a mole of something is this many particles. Right, so a mole of cars would be 6 times 10 to the 23rd cars. There hasn't ever been that many cars ever built yet. Right, that's a huge number. Right, so a mole of glucose is this exact number of particles, and if you look at the atomic mass, you can calculate that that equals 180 grams. Right, so for a molar solution, we take exactly one mole of glucose and put it in this flask right here when it's dry. Okay, no fluid in there, so you have a bunch of glucose as a crystal or a powder on the bottom, and then we take some water and fill this flask up to where it makes exactly 1 liter of solution. So how much water did you put in there? Exactly 1 liter, or maybe a little bit less? A little bit less, because glucose is taking up some of the space in there, right? So that's a molar solution, when you put the solvent and solute together to mix up exactly 1 liter of solution. That's a molar solution. Now, there's something called a molal solution, which is a little bit different. You still start with 180 grams of glucose, and what's that conceptually? What's 180 grams?
One.
That's one mole of glucose, okay? And then on top of that, you put in exactly 1 liter of water, right, which is a kilogram. That's how we standardize what a kilogram is, right? So a kilogram is exactly 1 liter of water. Then you put the glucose in. Okay, and then you put the water in, and then you have more than 1 liter of solution, right? Because water was 1 liter. So now you got a little bit extra, so that's what we call a molal solution. So there's a small difference between molar and molal solutions. Okay, as a matter of fact, for this molal solution, you could have started exactly with 1 liter of water in the flask, and then add glucose to it, and then the volume gets bigger after you add the glucose to it. It doesn't matter what you add first to this flask right here. Okay. There's another kind of concept. Since we're interested, so these osmotic properties are determined by the number of particles that are in solution. And we can understand that a little bit by knowing something about the molality or molarity of a solution. But some compounds are a little funky because when you put them in solution, they don't stay just one molecule. They don't just stay one mole. some particles actually break apart. We call that dissociation. And indeed, if we think of sodium chloride, right, if we put sodium chloride in solution, it's going to dissolve, it's going to break apart into a sodium ion and a chloride ion. All right, so now you don't have a 1 molal solution of sodium chloride right here because it breaks apart. What do you really have? Right, you've got a 2 osmolar solution because it breaks into 2 particles. And so that's going to further, right, cause water to diffuse through this selectively permeable membrane. So this is an example of osmosis, right, because glucose can't move across the membrane. Sodium or chloride can't, but water can. So water is going to move over, right, until the concentrations are of water is exactly the same right here. All right, so 1.5 molal solution of glucose is equal to a 0.75 molal solution of sodium chloride because sodium chloride breaks into 2 pieces. So you got to multiply this 0.75 times 2 to get the osmolar concentration, right? And what's 0.75 times 2? 1.5 osmolar. All right, so when these concentrations are equilibrated, when you have a 1.5 osmolar solution on either side of this membrane, then osmosis is going to stop. And the reason why that is because sodium chloride breaks into 2 compounds. It dissociates. Okay, so that's kind of an important consideration. All right, tonicity is a concept that we use that describes the effect of a solution on the osmotic movement of water. So let me see if I can draw some things on the board. And let's talk about a red blood cell. Here's a nice red blood cell right here. And a red blood cell has a number of solutes inside of it, and we're going to say that it is 0.9% salt. All right, so we're going to think of all the solutes as salt. I'm just going to put salt on the board. And, of course, there's what? Amino acids and glucose and other kinds of things, but I'm just going to say salt to be short. All right, so if all the solutes are 0.9%, how much water is inside this cell? So 100% minus 0.9, so that's going to be 99.1% H2O inside that cell right there. Okay. Now let's put this cell in a beaker that just has pure water in it. What would be the concentration of water if it's pure water in terms of a percent? 100%. Okay, so here's 100% H2O right here. All right, now, do you think there's a big difference between 100% and 99.1? Doesn't look like it's really big. Doesn't look like a big change right here. But nonetheless, is there a concentration gradient for water? It's high outside, low inside the cell. There are pores that allow water to go through, but not salt for this red blood cell. So water will move inside the cell. And when it does, what happens to the volume of the cell? Does it get smaller, stay the same? Yeah, you add stuff to it, right? It expands because of that osmotic pressure. And as a matter of fact, there's so much difference in this concentration gradient that this cell is actually going to swell up and it's going to explode, right? And we call that hemolysis. Even that small concentration gradient is going to hemolyze these cells. Okay, so when we need to talk about what kind of solution this is compared to inside the cell. Okay, this is a hypotonic solution, and a hypotonic solution is going to cause hemolysis, which is what? Blowing the cell up. Lysis is blowing the cell up. And as a matter of fact, if we wanted to keep these cells exactly the same shape, what kind of solution would we have to put it in? Okay, it would have to be what? A 0.9% salt solution in order to maintain the integrity of that cell. Right? And if the solution, right, that we put it in was 0.9% salt, the shape of the cell would not change. We call that isotonic. All right, so when you get an IV, for instance, you have a patient that needs an IV, you have to consider the tonicity of the solution that you're putting into them. Yeah, because if it's hypotonic, you're going to be destroying their red blood cells. You're going to be hemolyzing them. It has to be what? Isotonic. All right. Another circumstance. Let's take a beaker again. okay? Put a cell in there again, and a cell is what, 0.9% salt? Right here, 99.1% water, H2O. Now let's put that cell in a really salty solution, like maybe seawater, which is 5% salt. What's the concentration of water then? 95% H2O. All right, remember semipermeable membrane right here? Water can move across, but other solutes can't. Is water going to move? Okay, and it's going to move out. It's going to go from high concentration to low. Water is going to move through this membrane into the salt solution right here, and the cell is going to shrink up like that and get all jagged. You probably did this in lab, or I hope that you will. And we call this, this is what we call a hypertonic solution, right? The process of shrinking the cell right here is called crenation. When you crenate a cell, it shrivels up. And the other kind of interesting thing is when you crenate a cell, that's not an irreversible process. You can get it back to its original shape by doing what with it? Taking it, and putting it into an isotonic solution, and it will go back to its normal shape. Okay. Now, if you hemolyze a cell, can you get it back to its normal shape? If you hemolyze a cell, you blow it up. That's like taking a balloon and then popping the balloon. No matter what you do, scotch tape, duct tape, you can't make a balloon out of it again, right? Same thing for cells. So when you hemolyze a cell, that's irreversible. When a cell is crenated, that is reversible. You can if you put it in the proper solution. Okay, so how are you going to remember these terms? I have a trick that will work for a couple weeks. Okay. Yeah, at least up to the test. You should understand the mechanics of what's happening right here. All right, so here's a little trick. But as long as you don't tell anybody I told you this. Okay? Okay, here's a nice O in hypotonic. Here's a nice O in hemolysis. That matches up really nice in my way of thinking. All right, here's a nice E in hypertonic, and here's a nice E in crenation. All right, so at least check your thinking processes out with that little trick. All right, so that's something about tonicity, and it's a very important consideration, right, in physiology. So here we see in a hypotonic solution, all right, the cell is on its way to being hemolyzed. In a hypertonic solution, here we have a nice crenated cell. All right, now do these processes right here, the hemolysis and crenation, do they qualify for osmosis? What are the three things? It's got to be diffusion. Can't be active transport. Is it diffusion? Yeah, I don't see any ATP being used. What molecule is moving?
Water.
The solvent molecule, water, so that's two out of the three. And is there a selectively permeable membrane?
Yes,
because these salt particles can't move through, right? So they're osmotically active. Indeed, that does qualify for osmosis. All right, so you can imagine that controlling the osmolality or the water balance inside your body, or you could think of the salt balance as being very important because your cells can, what, expand and blow up, right? Or they can shrink down, they can change shape. So your body has to control the salt concentration or water concentration inside your body, and here's a nice mechanism that shows that. All right, so if you're dehydrated, say you're exercising and you're not drinking water, you're sweating a lot, you're losing a lot of water from your body, your blood volume decreases because you're losing water, which means you get what? Saltier on the inside. Your plasma osmolality increases. Your blood becomes more concentrated in solutes. And that can't go on for very long. So there's a spot in the brain, namely the hypothalamus, that has osmoreceptors. It can actually measure the water concentration of your plasma. Okay, and that's also the integration center. It can compare that to what it should be. And then if it's not within at the set point, it makes a decision on what to do to bring that parameter back to the set point. All right, well, if your inside of your body is too salty, too low on water, one really easy decision is to make you think that you're thirsty, give you the sensation of thirst. And what would you do? You would drink, right? You would drink water, all right? So you intake water, you take water in, and how does that correspond to this initial stimulus right here? It subtracts from it, so that's a nice negative feedback mechanism, right? Okay, so that brings your blood volume back up. That decreases the plasma osmolality, right? So it subtracts from the initial stimulus. That's just thirst. But there's another thing that happens too. The hypothalamus has control over the pituitary gland. They're right next to each other. They're connected by the, anybody know that tissue, how they're connected? The infundibulum, right, between the hypothalamus and the pituitary. And then so it goes to the posterior pituitary, and it tells cells to release antidiuretic hormone from the posterior pituitary. What's a diuretic do for you? Makes you pee, makes you void. An antidiuretic makes you do what? Hold water, makes you retain water. Well, and that's exactly what you're missing. You're missing water, so antidiuretic hormone makes you hold water because it works on the kidneys, and it makes you produce a very small amount of urine that's highly concentrated in salt. Right? So that makes you conserve water. And how does that correspond to this initial stimulus? It subtracts from it. So that helps you maintain water balance through antidiuretic hormone, or ADH, maintaining this nice negative feedback loop right here. And as a matter of fact, ADH is involved with another kind of diabetes that maybe you have heard about, maybe not have heard about it. You've heard of diabetes mellitus, which involves what important metabolite in your body? Glucose, right? Especially glucose in your blood is how you think about it. Right, and if you're a diabetic and your blood glucose is really high, one of the side effects is that puts you into diuresis, or that you're urinating all the time, right, to get that glucose out of your blood. All right, there's a condition where somebody's pituitary has a tumor, or for whatever reason doesn't secrete antidiuretic hormone. And if you don't have antidiuretic hormone, what state does that put you in? That state of diuresis where you're going to the bathroom all the time, just kind of mimics diabetes mellitus, right? So the kind of diabetes that is produced with an abnormality in ADH secretion is called diabetes insipidus. It's a little bit different, caused by a malfunction and a different kind of hormone. But nonetheless, you'll be urinating all the time. That's what we call diuresis. And when you lose that water, what are you then doing to compensate? You're drinking all the time. You're drinking water, right? But it's just flowing right through your body. So those conditions are kind of easy to diagnose, even at the grade school level, right? If somebody's drinking a gallon of water, you know, every half day or so, that's a nice indication that there's some kind of diabetes taking place in that person. Okay, so that, I think, is a good exam figure right there for you. All right, so we can now start talking about some membrane transport systems, and maybe you should know something about hemolysis and crenation, why that happens, right? All right, so let's talk about some different kinds of transport systems. So some molecules can move across the membrane by themselves according to a concentration gradient, right? And how would they move by themselves? High to low, passively, right? All right, but even if some molecules are high on the outside of the cell and low on the inside, they still can't get in. They can't get through the membrane. And you should understand something about some characteristics of those molecules that can't get in. They're either too large or they're polar, right? Because if they're polar, they can't get through that phospholipid bilayer, because that interior part of the membrane is lipid, and polar compounds just don't want to have anything to do with that lipid. They can't pass through it. All right, so if that is the case, well, the cell still might want to get some important molecules inside of it, like glucose, for instance. So there has to be another strategy besides simple diffusion. Then we call that carrier-mediated transport, where molecules must bind to a membrane protein before it is transported, before it goes down its concentration gradient. And there are three important characteristics of that kind of transport mechanism that we see right here. Okay. So here we have a graph of the rate of transport of some molecule. Let's just say glucose, X. X is some molecule. And then here is a plot versus the concentration of that molecule on the outside of the cell. And we can see, as the concentration increases of glucose, what happens to the transport? And if we look over here, we see that it is increasing. The rate is increasing. The rate is increasing as the concentration increases right here. That's shown by this solid line. Okay, now remember, glucose has to bind to a carrier molecule. And if it's bound to glucose already or another molecule, then that glucose can't bind to it. So, after all the carriers have bound all the glucose, as the concentration of glucose increases, the rate kind of levels off right here, because glucose, even though the concentration is increasing, all the transporters are already bound with glucose molecules, and they can't hop a ride because all those transport molecules are now busy doing their job. All right, so we call that saturation when it levels off right here. Okay. The other thing is specificity. Those transporters will only carry certain kinds of molecules across the membrane, and that's based on the shape. Right? So only molecules with the right shape will be transported across the membrane. Glucose has the right shape. Maybe some other molecules that are similar to it, like galactose, that have a fairly similar shape, they can be transported as well. But another molecule that is different in shape, like an amino acid or a fatty acid, totally different kind of shape, can't bind to the transporter, and right, they won't be transported. So we call that specificity. Carrier-mediated transport will only take a molecule across the membrane if it has the right shape. If it has the wrong shape, it's stuck outside. All right. The other characteristic that carrier-mediated transport has is that if you have two molecules, one molecule that's glucose, or X right here, and another molecule that has almost the right shape, like galactose, galactose can bind to that carrier, and when galactose binds to it, glucose can't bind. And so what happens then is that not as much glucose can be transported across the membrane if there is competition, okay, for that particular site in the transporter. All right, so there is a different transport mechanism, a lower saturation level if there is competition. For instance, if you have both glucose and a similar molecule in solution, like galactose. All right, now you wouldn't have competition if this molecule here was a lot different in shape, like if it was an amino acid or a fatty acid, for instance, because it doesn't have the right specificity to bind to that carrier molecule. All right, so this is, you should know these three characteristics of carrier-mediated transport. All right, now what can you tell me about facilitated diffusion? Is it active or passive?
Active.
It is a passive process. Any kind of diffusion is passive. Okay, yeah. Any kind of diffusion is passive, which means molecules are going to go from what? High to low, just like my car without the engine on, right? We'll roll down the hill. All right, so here we have a membrane, nice plasma membrane, phospholipid bilayer. Here's that lipid region that polar molecules cannot go through, just can't get through the membrane. All right, and glucose is a polar compound. It dissolves readily in water, but means it can't diffuse, it can't dissolve into the membrane. Here we have a high concentration on the outside of the cell, low concentration on the inside. Does glucose want to go inside the cell? Yeah, passively. It wants to go down its concentration gradient, but it can't because the membrane is a barrier. So what do cells do? They figure out a way to get it inside. It's an important metabolite. They use a carrier molecule, a protein that's dissolved in the plasma membrane. So glucose can diffuse into this cleft within this protein, and it's going to bind to this particular protein. You see a site where it will bind. Notice that the shape of the site where it binds and the shape of the molecule that's being transported is complementary. Sometimes we call lock and key or hand and glove, but it has to be complementary in order for glucose to bind in this location. If this was a triangular spot or a square spot or circular, it wouldn't bind with, because it doesn't have the specificity to bind right there. So when glucose binds, there's some energy associated with that, right? And that's going to change a conformation in the protein. So now instead of being open to the outside is closed and a way to the inside is now open. We see a changing a conformation right there. Yeah, don't forget the sign-in sheet. All right, and so now this protein is open to the inside of the cell and glucose then diffuses to the inside of the cell. We call this carrier-mediated or facilitated diffusion. All right, so you might be wondering, you know, what's causing this conformation change, right? And when glucose is released from the active site, guess what happens to this protein? It goes back to this conformation right here. So when glucose binds to this protein, you should think of your friend like poking you in the side, okay? Just a little bit, It's not really much energy, but what? It's fairly irritating to you. You're going to do what? You're going to change conformation, right, when that glucose molecule binds to your side. All right, so these are small energy changes, but that allows glucose to go down its concentration gradient from high to low. And cells can regulate that, right? And it regulates it because it can take these transporters right here, it can sequester this part of the membrane and put it inside the cell in a vesicle that we call an endosome. And when these glucose transporters are inside the cell in this vesicle, notice that the plasma membrane no longer has any transporters, so the glucose is stuck outside the cell. Okay? But now let's just say you're in a fed state, your blood glucose levels go way up, and the cell wants to take glucose. Guess what it can do with this endosome right here? It can hop a ride on a microtubule, right? It can get placed next to the plasma membrane again, and then since it has the phospholipid bilayer, they fuse together, and now you have all these transporters inserted into the membrane, and glucose can go from inside to outside down a concentration gradient. And there's a signal that puts these transporters in the membrane, and that's called insulin. Okay? Insulin allows cells to insert these endosomes that have all these glucose transporters and put them in the membrane. Right? So insulin basically does what? Allows it, it's a passport that allows glucose to enter cells because it puts these carrier proteins, which we call GLUT4, like for glucose, and it was the fourth one that people discovered. It's a very common one that allows the cell to take up glucose. Now, when you're in a fasted state and blood glucose levels start to go down, these transporters are then taken out and put into this endosome, where they no longer can decrease the amount of glucose that's in the blood. So this is a nice control feature, right, for the glucose system. That's facilitated diffusion. Okay, can you read the top line right there? There's a button I can push to get it to scale properly, but I'm not sure I know where it is. And I don't want to push the wrong button and turn everything off. So if you can live with that word being chopped off, what does it say right there? Active transport, right? Okay, so we're switching modes a little bit from passive to active. And if it's active transport, which way can a molecule move? Yeah, from low concentration to high. All right, but just like my car going to the top of the hill, it requires something. It requires energy of some kind, and a good source of energy, one source of energy in your cell that's readily available if you're healthy is ATP. Okay. So here we have that phospholipid bilayer again, that's just a plasma membrane, and let's consider a molecule that's different from glucose, and that is calcium. Now, can calcium diffuse through the membrane by itself? Okay, and why is that? You've got to be really familiar with that. Hopefully that's right on the tip of your tongue. Why can't calcium move through the membrane? Because, yeah, it's an ion, that means it's very polar, right? It's hydrophilic. And this is a hydrophobic region on the outside. So this is a huge barrier to calcium. It can't move through. All right, so in terms of active transport, your cell then builds a protein right here. And it kind of looks like that facilitated carrier for glucose. It has a couple sides to it, and it's got a little space on the inside. So calcium can diffuse into this cleft inside the protein. So now it's inside this protein that spans the membrane, okay? But just by binding or being inside this protein, there's not enough energy for it to change conformation. So now there is also an active site right here that can bind ATP. ATP is going to be bound to it, and it's going to hydrolyze ATP, which means what? Splitting it into smaller molecules. And then when it does, the energy in that covalent bond of that last phosphate, the third phosphate, all right, is released into this protein, and it changes a conformation. It causes a conformation change of this protein, so now it's closed on the inside, it's open to the outside world, and calcium can move into the extracellular fluid. So for active transport, it's not like just your friend poking you in the side. It's like your friend having a taser and putting it on your side and pushing the button, right? It releases a lot of energy that produces what? A big conformation change. So calcium can go from low to high as long as you have some energy available to do that, namely in terms of ATP. And generally, that kind of protein that can move things from low to high Like a pump for pumping water out of the ground, going from low to high, we call it a pump, right? And that requires ATP. So ion pumps require ATP to move molecules against their concentration gradient. One important pump in your body, I think most of the energy that you use in your body over a 24-hour period, right, is not when you're exercising, not when you're studying really, really hard, but even when you're sleeping, is to maintain this pump right here. Right? This is the most important pump in your body. It's called the sodium-potassium ATP pump. Right? So a pump, by its name, means that it requires ATP. So when I say sodium-potassium ATP pump, that's, what do you call that when you say something twice? That's what, oxymoron? Is that an oxymoron? That's an oxymoron, okay? Because a pump requires what? ATP. I just said it twice. I used to live in a really interesting neighborhood in Boulder, Colorado. Talk about an oxymoron. It was called Table Mesa neighborhood. Some of you would know what that means, right? That means I lived in table. Okay, so don't forget, the pump requires what? ATP. Okay. Now, this pump right here is a little interesting because it will pump potassium inside the cell and pump sodium outside. All right, so that means that potassium in a normal cell is low outside, but it is high inside. Potassium won't normally go from outside to inside by diffusion, right? So this is an active transport process. The same thing for sodium. Sodium is high outside the cell, so for sodium to go from inside to outside, that requires some energy. It requires a pump, in particular the sodium-potassium pump right here. The other interesting thing about this sodium-potassium pump is that it doesn't pump equal amounts of sodium and potassium across the membrane when it's doing its job. It pumps three out and only two in. So every time it does its job, pumping two out, two sodiums out, but three in, can you see that that, oh, I'm sorry, three sodium, I hope I said three sodiums out and two potassiums in, okay? Can you see that that develops an imbalance of electrical charge, right? So if it's pumping three positive charges out but only two in, what happens to the inside of this cell as this pump is doing its job? It becomes what? Less positive. It becomes less positive because it's pumping less positive ions in. That's exactly the same thing as saying that it becomes more negative. Right? Since it's less positive, it becomes more negative because of this sodium-potassium pump right here. All right? And that requires ATP to do that. All right, so that is an important kind of pump. And since you see it's using ATP right here, you know it's active. Furthermore, it's another type of active transport. We're going to learn two types of active transport. If it uses ATP directly when it's doing its job, we call that primary active transport because it's using ATP. Okay. There's another kind of transport that we call secondary. So this is not primary active transport. All right. It's still active transport, so it needs energy, but it can use a different kind of energy. Let's see if I can develop this concept. Secondary active transport will be dependent on a primary active transport someplace within the cell, which means what? It's going to require ATP. Okay? So, for instance, the sodium-potassium pump uses ATP. That's primary active transport. It's going to pump sodium from low concentration to high, which is what? Outside of the cell. It's going to pump sodium outside the cell. So now we have a big gradient of sodium, high on the outside, very low on the inside of the cell. So you could actually think of my car as being like that sodium ion right there, high on the outside of the cell. Where does it want to go? It wants to go down the hill, right? It wants to get back inside the cell because that's a concentration gradient. And so it required energy to get up on the hill right here. And then every once in a while, there are certain transporters that will allow sodium to move inside the cell. So it's going to fall off of this cliff, and it's going to hit this teeter-totter right here because that same molecular transporter not only binds sodium, but it's going to bind a glucose molecule as well. And there is enough energy in sodium moving into the cell down the concentration gradient that it can take glucose and move it across the membrane as well. Okay, and so whenever there is an active transport process, taking glucose from low concentration to high, right? That's got to be active transport. And it doesn't use ATP directly, but it uses a gradient in another compound. We call that secondary active transport. So over here, I don't see ATP being used, so that's not primary active transport. It's using a gradient. So don't forget, there is energy in a gradient. Just like when my car was on top of the hill, there's energy in my car because it's on top of the hill. It can be used by starting the car to roll down the hill. And by letting sodium move down its concentration gradient, that energy can be used to move glucose up its concentration gradient. We call that secondary active transport. So let's look at a couple real-world situations. All right, so secondary active transport. When you look at a diagram, okay, since it's active transport, which way is a molecule going to move? From low concentration to high. Always start with that, okay? So here we have glucose, okay, which is low concentration outside the cell, and we're going to move it to high concentration inside. All right, so it's going to go from low to high. What is that going to require? Energy. It's going to require energy of some kind. ATP is a good example, but not a really good one for this example that I have on the slide. We're going to see that there's another energy source available. Here's sodium. Where is sodium high? Outside the cell, right, because of the sodium-potassium pump. It wants to flow in. So here's a special transporter that will bind both sodium and glucose. And when both sodium and glucose bind, it's going to cause a conformation change in this membrane right here. And now glucose and sodium can move to the inside of the cell. So sodium goes from high to low, right? And then glucose goes from low to high. There's enough energy in the concentration gradient of sodium to drag this glucose along with it. So that's what we call secondary active transport, because when you look at this slide right here, do you see any ATP on this slide? No ATP. Nonetheless, glucose is going from low to high. All right? The energy source that's being used is the concentration gradient of sodium to get glucose to move into the cell. All right, so that's got to be secondary active transport because no ATP is directly being used. So we got two different kinds of secondary active transport. If both molecules move in the same direction, as in this example right here, we call that a co-transport or symport transport system because the molecules are moving in the same direction. All right, if the molecules move in opposite directions, we would call that antiport or counter-transport, but in every case, it's going to be a secondary active transport mechanism, using the energy in the gradient of one of those molecules that's going to go from high to low to drive the other one from low to high, okay, is secondary active transport. Here is a really good example of that system. So here we have your blood, and then here we have the lumen of some kind of tubule. It could be a small intestine or kidney tubule. And we're going to see how some important molecules can go from low concentration to high, low concentration in this lumen right here to high concentration in the blood. Okay, because glucose, important molecule, you don't want to lose any, right? You don't want to lose any in feces, you don't want to lose any in urine. Your body wants to recover every last glucose molecule possible. So it's going to go from low to high. How is that possible? Okay, well, this is a nice epithelium right here. Here's the apical surface. Here's the basal surface. And most cells, or most epithelia, the apical surface is definitely a lot different than the basal surface right here. And we're going to see that's especially true in terms of the proteins that are in the membrane, these transporters. So here we have a transporter, okay, that will bind both sodium and glucose. All right, so sodium is high on the outside of the cell, low on the inside, so sodium wants to go in. And that gradient, what does that gradient have? It has energy associated with it, right? Even like my car had a dead battery, by being on top of the hill, there was enough energy to get the engine started. Okay, but now glucose is low on the outside and high on the inside. What's that going to require to get glucose to go from low to high? Some kind of energy, and there's enough energy in this gradient of sodium so that this transporter right here will allow both to enter this cell. Now, do you see any ATP being involved right here? No. So is that primary act of transport or secondary? It's got to be secondary because it doesn't require any, I don't see any ATP, but it's getting the energy from the gradient of sodium. And since both molecules are moving in the same direction, what do we call that? That is symport or co-transport, since both molecules are moving in the same direction. Co-transport? Yeah, co-transport. Yeah, it's co-transport or symport. They're kind of synonyms of each other. All right, so now we've got sodium, which is low inside the cell because you got the pumping it out all the time. Now you got glucose, high concentration, and in the blood it's low. So what about glucose? What does it want to do? It wants to move out of the cell into the blood down its concentration gradient. It can't because it can't get through the membrane right here, but aha, that's not a really big problem because here's a nice transporter for it, like the GLUT4 transporter, right, that will facilitate its diffusion from inside the cell into the blood. So now glucose, right, has all been taken out of this fluid in the lumen and put in the blood, which is exactly what we want. The last thing that we have to maintain is to maintain sodium at a really low concentration inside the cell, and you should be familiar with a pump that all day long is pumping sodium out of cells, and that is the sodium potassium ATP pump, pumping sodium out. But now, what kind of active transport is this? Okay, because it's going from low to high, sodium is going from low to high. You see ATP being used, that is as active transport, but what kind? That's primary active transport, so that's what you got a key on. If it's ATP being used, that's primary active transport. If ATP is not being used to move something from low to high, that is secondary active transport. Okay, so cells have to play these tricks with membrane proteins all the time. Okay, so that's an important exam figure right there. That's an important exam figure. All right, here, endocytosis, exocytosis, we kind of talked about already. That's just moving bulk materials, large particles from inside to outside the cell. And is that active or passive? It's active. It's going to require ATP to move these vesicles around inside the cell. So I think that's all I'm going to say about that. Okay. Okay, well, let's see what I can say about membrane potential. Okay. Membrane, it has something to do with a membrane, like the cell membrane, okay? And potential right here is just kind of a fancy word for voltage. And a voltage just means that in one area, you have a lot of one kind of charge, like a positive charge, and in another area, you have accumulation of the opposite charge, a negative charge, okay? And they call that a potential because, what can you tell me about opposite charges? They attract each other. So these things will want to move to neutralize each other, right? So that is potential energy, right? And we call that voltage. So do you use voltage all the time in your daily life? Yeah, there were times with my car I wish I had a lot more in what? The battery, the starter battery, but you need a battery for your computers or cell phones or whatever, right? So when you have a separation of charge, when you have a gradient of charge, right, that's an energy source that can be used to do work. So how many terminals does a battery have? Usually it's got two, right? It's got a plus terminal, a minus terminal, and those charges want to hop across those terminals to neutralize each other. Okay. Well, cells are exactly the same thing. Cells, every cell in your body acts like a battery. Okay? And I really hate to do this, but I can't get through this chapter before the test. So I got to postpone the test. That's terrible. So the test can't be on Tuesday. It's got to be on Thursday. Okay. So instead of on the 7th, all right, it's on the 9th. Yeah, I'm for sure about that. Okay, so the test, all right, now you got to bust your butt over the weekend still. It doesn't matter if the test is on Tuesday or Thursday. It's still, this is still kind of rough material for a lot of people, all right? But, all right, so let me continue on with membrane potential. All right, it's still really, really important, even though we're postponing the test till Thursday. All right, so membrane potential has something to do this with this membrane right here. And potential means voltage. It just means that there's a difference in charge, electrical charge, as you move across the membrane. All right, and we're going to see how this really develops. All right, so I think maybe I want to draw some things back on the board. All right, so here we got some positive charges right here. What kind of ion has a positive charge, for instance? Yeah, potassium, sodium have a positive charge. That's really, really good. All right, so see, even just erasing takes some class time up. I need a button to erase everything. That's going to be like, I need to learn how to use this electronic whiteboard. And there's one right here and right there. And we're still working some of the bugs out of it, so I don't want to waste a lot of time. We're reprogramming some of these. That room works a little bit different than this room. So we're going to unify how these work so I can flip back and forth a whole lot easier. All right, let's draw this cell right here. Because I know if I were to project the whiteboard, it would be like 10 times better already. Okay, so here we have a cell. And let's just say that it is permeable to potassium. Okay, and so let's put a lot of potassium on the outside of this cell right here and no potassium on the inside, and it's permeable to potassium. What's going to happen if we wait a long time? Potassium is going to move in, right? And what's going to happen to the concentration? If you got four potassiums on the outside, how many are you going to have on the inside? You're going to have four, right? Because then the concentrations are the same, that reaches equilibrium. The net diffusion in is going to equal the net diffusion out. Potassium, then the net movement is going to stop, right? And what's going to be the charge across the membrane right here? Is there going to be a difference in charge? What do we see? Plus 4 on the outside, plus 4 on the inside. Okay. Now, that doesn't really represent a very good living cell, because inside of a living cell, we have millions of other kinds of molecules that have a large negative charge on them. Okay, like DNA and proteins and things like that. And we call, what do we call a negative ion? Anion, right? So we have, right, millions of molecules of anions, and these are huge molecules, okay? So it's a minus sign. They're huge, so guess what? These anions can't get through the membrane. They're stuck inside the cell, but they belong inside the cell, right? Your chromosomes belong inside the cell. Proteins belong inside the cell. All right, so now you have thousands of negative charge right here. What's going to happen to the equilibrium for potassium? The first equilibrium that we looked at was just the chemical equilibrium, right? The concentration. It was exactly equal. Now we got to consider another kind of equilibrium, and that is the equilibrium due to this electrical charge. All right, so now we have more electrical charges inside the cell, right, compared to outside because of all these anions right here that are trapped inside the cell. What's going to happen to potassium? What can you say about opposite charges? They attract each other. So all these proteins are going to do what? They're going to attract potassium to the inside of the cell to neutralize each other. Okay? And a new equilibrium is going to be established to where you're going to have more potassium inside the cell than outside. All right. But as we build up potassium inside the cell, what happens to the concentration gradient? You got high potassium on the inside, low on the outside, and what's going to happen to potassium? It's going to want to leave. Okay? All right. So there's a new equilibrium that establishes itself to where potassium wants to leave to equalize the concentration, but the same amount wants to enter to neutralize the electrical charge right here. So there's a new kind of equilibrium, and there will be higher potassium inside compared to the outside of the cell. So there's going to be a balance between the attraction being pulled in, right, and then the concentration gradient trying to shove it out. All right, and we call that the equilibrium potential. Is what is the charge inside the cell where these two processes exactly cancel themselves out? Okay, and so that's what we have right here. Okay, so we can actually measure that voltage. Right here is a voltmeter right here. We can stick I don't know if anybody ever used a voltmeter, okay, but you can measure, you need two terminals, you can measure any kind of battery. One end of the voltmeter stays outside the cell, and the other we poke inside the cell, and we can measure the voltage from outside to inside. And if we were to measure for potassium, we'd see that there is minus 90 millivolts. That means that the inside is negative. And it's a little negative because of all these fixed anions inside the cell, and there can't be enough potassium to enter the cell to neutralize that completely, because as the concentration of potassium builds up inside the cell, what else happens? That stimulates diffusion out, because diffusion works by a concentration gradient, all right? But it's going to reach a new equilibrium, right? At that new equilibrium, it produces a minus 90 millivolt voltage across the cell. All right, so that means that the electrical attraction is equally balanced with the amount that of the diffusion allowing potassium to leave the cell. So we call that the equilibrium potential for potassium. Right, but that might happen for a number of compounds. All right, this Nernst equation right here tells us what that voltage is that balances out exactly the drive for potassium to leave the cell. All right, so here is an equation right here that shows that. And it's another one of these log functions, so that's why you need your little log calculator for the test. Here's the equation. And if we take the log of the concentration of the ion outside the cell compared to the inside, right, divide those two, take the log, base 10 of it, and then multiply it by 61, and then divide by the valence. All right, what's the valence of an ion? Yeah, it's those outer electron is the overall charge of that ion. Okay, so how would you talk about sodium? Is it a monovalent, bivalent, divalent, trivalent? Sodium?
Monovalent.
Yeah, it has one. It has one plus charge, so it's a monovalent cation. And cation means what? Plus or minus? It's plus. All right, so that's what you would put for Z right here. For sodium would be a plus one. Well, what's 61 over plus 1? That's pretty easy. That's just 61, right? That's just 61. So you multiply the log of the concentration gradient times 61, and that would tell you the millivolts that develop across the membrane for this one ion particle, right? Either sodium or potassium or calcium or chloride or any which one. Okay, so the Nernst equation can't take into consideration all of the ions together, just one at a time. This might be a little bit of a downfall. All right, so here is something that I want you to memorize, the gradients for four important ions. All right, so we got sodium, which is a monovalent cation. We got potassium, which is a monovalent cation. We've got chloride right here, which is a monovalent anion. All right, and then calcium, which is a divalent cation. I was thinking of the Nernst equation. Okay, so what's Z for the Nernst equation for these four ions? It would be plus 1. Z would be plus 1 for sodium. For potassium, it would be plus 1 over here. And then for chlorine, it would be minus 1 for Z. And then for calcium, it would be plus 2. That's how you would do that. Okay, and now here's something else I want you to know. Where is sodium high in a resting cell? Outside the cell, right? 145 millimolar compared to 12 inside. Potassium, where is it high? Inside the cell. What about chlorine? It's high outside, all right? So it's going to want to diffuse in. And calcium is high where? Way higher outside. Look, it's almost zero on the inside of the cell, okay? So it's being pumped out all the time. All right, so knowing these differences in concentration, you can use the Nernst equation to figure out for at least one of these ions at a time, what is the voltage that develops across the cell. Okay, so here is just a little practice formula. Okay, so for potassium, right, here's the equilibrium potential for potassium. What's the concentration? It is 5 on the outside, 150 on the inside, right? So here, 5 on the outside, 150. And if you work the calculation right, that produces a voltage right at equilibrium of minus 90 millivolts. So So not enough potassium can enter the cell to neutralize this negative charge, because as more potassium moves in, what happens to the concentration gradient? It gets bigger, forcing it out, right? So that's a new equilibrium constant. That's a new equilibrium that's established. And the Nernst equation allows you to calculate it for each one of these ions right here. Okay, and I forgot if I modified this slide right here. If this is 60 or 66. There might be a mistake in this one right here. If we got time, I'll try to punch it through with my calculator. So this equation should kind of remind you of something. What does it kind of remind you of? Like the pH equation, right, is a logarithmic function to it. It's just that the pH doesn't have any scalars on the in front of it right here, like this 61, and it does, and the valence plays no part because hydrogen is always plus one. Okay. All right, so there's a resting membrane potential that's developed in every cell. So every cell in your body acts like a battery. It's negative on the inside, positive on the outside. And in most cells in your body, it ranges between minus 65 and minus 85. And so that's why we just say on an average cell, it's minus 70 millivolts. We just kind of use that as a round number. All right, so what does that depend on? RMP, and when I say RMP, what am I talking about? Resting membrane potential, just a voltage across the membrane when the cell's not active, when it's not doing anything, when it's just sitting there being alive. Okay, it depends on the permeability to each ion that you're just going to have to memorize, but we'll use that later on in the class. All right, and it's affected most by potassium because that's the ion that's most permeable across the membrane. Okay, so if in real life, if we include all of the ions, like chloride and calcium and sodium, right, a typical cell develops minus 70 millivolts. Right, and cells are going to use that for a lot of activity, right? So like maybe nerve impulses, for instance, right? Because nerves work on electrical principles, and that's based on this membrane right here and the concentrations, the permeabilities of various ions in a cell. Okay. Plus what else? Well, it also relies on the fact that you have that sodium-potassium pump, right? Because it doesn't pump equal numbers of sodium and potassium. We say this pump is electrogenic because this sodium-potassium pump, what does it make the inside of the cell?
Negative.
It makes it negative because it's pumping out three positives, but only two positives are coming in. So that helps, right, maintain the negativity inside the cell. That's an important consideration. All right, so there are a number of things that make the resting membrane potential. First, the inside of the cell, because of all those fixed ions, are a little bit negative. All those proteins make it a little bit negative on the inside. All right, and there are unequal permeabilities to potassium and sodium across the membrane. These would like to diffuse in, right? Sodium can't because it can't get through the membrane. Potassium can a little bit. All right, so potassium moves inside the cell to equalize the charge inside the cell. All right. The membrane potential is due to that Nernst equation again. If you calculate the membrane potential just due to the concentrations across the membrane, and that's due to what? The sodium-potassium pump that produces an uneven distribution of ions. All right, so the equilibrium potential for potassium is about minus 90 millivolts. The equilibrium potential for sodium by itself is plus 66. Right, but if you consider all of these things, you just can't add these equilibrium potentials together. Right, we get that minus 70. So minus 90 plus 66 is not equal to minus 70 because of permeability differences, because of the sodium-potassium pump, right, changes it in the favor for it to be more negative than what the Nernst equation would tell you. The Nernst equation can only tell you for one ion at a time, but we know there are what? At least four important ions. And if you were to do all those ions together, consider the pump and the permeabilities, right, the inside of the cell is minus 70 compared to the outside of the cell. Okay, so that's kind of cell membrane. Maybe I can go over that again on Tuesday. And then on Tuesday, we're going to finish up with cell signaling. So some of these figures are pretty important. All right, and this here is an exam figure. So we'll go over that on Tuesday as well. This one right here. So we're almost done with this chapter, but not quite. So that gives you a little time to kind of do the homework assignments, online assignments. And here is the sign-in sheet for today.
Yeah. Every calculator is a little bit different.
Can you show me how to do it?
Yeah, let me turn the